All right, Alexander, let's talk about Project Ukraine and what is happening with the conflict. We have Russian advances across the entire front line. We still have Ukraine denying that Russia has captured Konstantinovka. The collective West is denying that Russia has captured Konstantinovka, but Russia has captured Konstantinovka. And you have the constant strikes into Russia from Ukraine, from the collective West, the United States providing a lot of, providing all of the Starlink targeting, everything like that. Mm-hmm. You had a naval strike, a strike into Russian oil tankers, actually, in the port off of Rostov. Different accounts. Russia says two tankers were hit. Ukraine sources say anywhere between 8 to 20 tankers, though the tankers were empty. They had no fuel, but still a pretty large escalation, a significant escalation in the Sea of Azov. And you have Putin in a meeting with cabinet officials, and they discuss the energy situation. Peskov also talking about the SMO and whether it still is an SMO. The line from the Kremlin is still to not criticize the United States, to not put any of the blame on the United States, to put it all on Europe. Putin's comments with regards to the energy situation seems very relaxed, very chill, I guess is the word that I'm looking for. He doesn't seem very concerned about it. He says that Russia's fine, it's resilient, and we're speeding things up, and we're going to focus on Crimea, but the Ukrainians, the enemy, he says, they want to damage our economy and create panic, but it will never work. He doesn't seem very concerned about the energy situation. I get different stories from people. Some people say there isn't a problem. Other people say there is a problem. It's something to be concerned about.
Well, indeed, absolutely. Right.
It was a bizarre statement from Putin. But anyway.
Let me first of all begin by saying that, you know, we are in a very, very strange situation at the moment in the Ukraine conflict, where there is extraordinary euphoria. There is, if you go and listen to, you know, what Western political leaders are saying, what some commentators are writing, what is being published by all sorts of, you know, people who are friendly to Ukraine on X and other places. I mean, they are all in a state of euphoria. I mean, they believe that they have Russia on the back foot, that everything is going well, that Ukraine is winning the war, even as in reality, on the front lines, in terms of strikes, in the fuel and energy situation, in the economic situation, the situation for Ukraine is getting worse. Now, that, of course, has been something that I have been saying for a while, but we've just had a long article in the Daily Telegraph by none other than Valery Zaluzhny, former Ukrainian military chief. Remember him? He comes back. He's very careful, obviously, what he says, because as I understand it, he's still Ukraine's ambassador to London. But basically, he says all this narrative, all this story is just absolute nonsense. Things are not changing on the battlefronts. They're getting worse in the economy. They're not achieving the effects against Russia that people said. It's an effort by Zaluzhny, I think, to try to puncture this sense of euphoria that exists. But of course, it won't be punctured. Nothing that happens. The fall of Konstantinovka, the massive strikes that we just saw on Kiev, that colossal explosion that took place near Kiev, where apparently all the depleted uranium shells, that's what we're told, exploded, all of that. Nothing seems to shake people's belief in the West that things are going well, even as they increasingly go badly. It's very, very strange. I've spoken to a few people with long memories, well, to be precise, two people with long memories, And they tell me that it reminds them a little of the mood in the West on the eve of the Tet Offensive, North Vietnam's Tet Offensive in 1968. Except my own view is that even an event as big as the Tet Offensive is incapable of shaking this euphoria. Anyway, that's a general point I wanted to make. Let's talk about this meeting that Putin had with the government. This is, by the way, a scheduled regular meeting with with top government officials that Putin regularly has. What happened was that about a week ago, he convened a special meeting to discuss the fuel and energy situation. He gave various instructions there, mostly to Novak, Alexander Novak, who is the deputy prime minister in charge of the fuel and energy complex. And what then happened within the context of this scheduled regular cabinet meeting was that Novak reported back to Putin on the success or otherwise of his team in implementing Putin's instructions of a week ago. So a lot of what people are reporting as what Putin said was actually said by Novak. Now, I have to say, I read this long discussion, and the overwhelming feeling I got, not for the first time, was a sense of déjà vu, in the sense that every summer, there are problems with the fuel situation, particularly the gasoline situation in Russia. Every summer, there is a meeting to discuss the gasoline situation in Russia. Every year, they all talk about the things that need to be done to sort it out, and they never get sorted out. The same problems continue to recur year after year after year. And of course, this year, as last year, but more this year, we have the added complication, the real complication, of the Ukrainian drone strikes on the Russian refineries. Now, I sent you an article a couple of days ago about how Russia doesn't have enough or only has barely enough refineries to produce gasoline for the civilian domestic market. What I didn't explain, and this is a very well-established thing, is that all of these refineries in Russia are owned by the big oil companies, by Lukoil, Rosneft, all of them. And Lukoil, Rosneft, and all of them also operate gas filling stations around Russia. But most of the gas filling stations in Russia and all of the gas filling stations in Crimea are run by independents. Now, what always happens in the summer months is that there's a general shortage of gasoline because the refineries don't produce enough gasoline for the peak energy fuel use, fuel demands for gasoline in the summer. What then happens is that the big oil companies limit sales of gasoline, or rather retain the gasoline they do produce for use in their own filling stations. And the independents get choked. And there's always, every year, there's a discussion about how bad that is, how the big companies should be made to change their behavior. And of course, that never changes and nothing is ever done about it. And there's lots of talk about increasing the number of refineries, and nothing ever gets done about that. And there's talk about encouraging private companies to set up small refineries such as exist in China, and nothing is ever done about that. And moreover, nothing is going to be done about it this year or next year, because the high interest rates make that absolutely impossible. Small businesses just don't have the ability to raise the kind of loans that are going to be needed to build refineries. So we're going to have this problem again next year and the year after. We're going to have these meetings and nothing gets done about this. This is, if you want me to say that, you know, there is a failure in Russian government governance, this is a failure. I mean, they focus on things like aerospace, on microchips, on machine building. They've never, ever shown a true ability to sort out this problem. And of course, at the same time, we have the drone attacks that are taking place, which are adding to the disruption in the refineries and are making things worse. Because when you have this kind of tense situation on a fuel in the fuel industry that you do every year, then even relatively small disruptions, which there always are going to be aggravated in particular places. And that, again, is what we're seeing. And one particular place where we're seeing this acutely is Crimea. And there are two reasons for this. Firstly, access to Crimea is difficult because the road and rail and shipping links are vulnerable because they're close to the front lines. And secondly, because of the fact that the big Russian oil companies, Rosneft, Lukoil, and the others, complied for many years with Western sanctions, something which this meeting did not say. They have not established their own gas filling stations in Crimea. Crimea entirely depends on independence to run gas filling stations. And the big Russian oil companies are not interested in providing gasoline to them. So these are problems, as I said, which are systemic. They've always existed. A strong leader such as Putin is supposed to be, ought to have cut through them years ago. I don't know why he hasn't. Maybe he's not interested in it. Maybe the people that are close to him are too close to the big oil companies. But the meeting we've just had is just essentially a repeat of meetings I've read and learned about for many years, with the added twist, as I said, that this is all happening in the middle of a war with the drone strikes, organized by the United States, authorized by Trump himself, cheered on by Rubio, backed by the Europeans, enabled by the Chinese. All of these things are happening.
Yeah, Putin is fighting the weirdest war. Mm. He's implemented the weirdest strategy I've ever seen in a war. As you summed it up, he needs to get on top of this gas situation. He just doesn't seem interested in it.
No.
And the problems that Russia has with gas over the many years, which they have every summer, has been greatly amplified by these drone strikes. Drones that hit the Moscow refinery, a drone that hit the Omsk refinery, 2,500 kilometers away.
Yes.
And Putin just doesn't seem at all interested in any of this. And they're still going with the line, Peskov, the Russian media, of Trump being the trusted partner, the person that listens to our interests, the person that understands us, while Trump is at the NATO summit with Rubio saying, yeah, we're going to hit Russia as hard as we can, and we're going to definitely get long-range strikes into Russia. Absolutely. That's exactly what we're going to do. It's so bizarre.
Well,
10D chess from Putin, maybe. Putin that's checked out, also possible. Who knows? Also have the admission from the collective West that they have no air defense at all.
No.
At all.
I know.
Okay. It's a huge admission.
Stop telling me. Yeah. Let me first of all just explain one important thing. There is no, and this came out of the meeting as well, there is no actual critical shortage of gasoline in Russia. I mean, the refineries might be disrupted, but if there was a functioning system that was able to move gasoline and diesel around Russia, there would be no shortages, no visible shortages at all. There are all kinds of bottlenecks, which are created, as I said, by all of these various structural problems that I have been talking about, which continue and compound year after year. There must be a reason why this is never really sorted. And again, I suspect that a lot of it is connected with the enormous influence of the big Russian companies, the big oil companies. But Putin's inability ever to get on top of it is very strange. Likewise, there is, yeah, I mean, we're talking about gasoline. Gasoline, apparently, the amount of gasoline in Russia in the reserves is about the same as it was last year. So if things were being distributed evenly, we would not have issues. And we would not have issues with spikes and disruptions in particular refineries, which never last very long. The system would absorb them without any difficulty. But we have always this period around this time where, as I said, we do tend to see these disruptions. And with diesel, it's even more strange because Russia has a huge reserve of diesel. But routinely, they stop diesel exports in the summer in order to make sure that agriculture, farm, that there's enough diesel to bring in the harvest, which again is actually extremely strange because it shouldn't be necessary given that Russia produces so much more diesel than it consumes in any one year. There are, as I said, problems which could have been solved, ought to have been solved, and it seems to me never are. I've been hearing about this issue for about 15 years now. But anyway, as for the way in which the war is being conducted, the general pattern of the war, I come back to what I was saying, a couple of just after I came back from Russia. Putin's strategy is one to maintain normalcy inside Russia, to avoid anything that might give the impression inside Russia that the country is indeed at war, and allow the military, the professional military, contract soldiers to carry on with the war in Ukraine and to win it in that way. And it may take longer than full national mobilization would do. But I think what Putin worries about is that if he went for that kind of mobilization, that would encounter serious opposition within Russian society. It would disrupt the sense of normalcy within Russian society. And Putin, of course, doesn't want that to, doesn't want to shake that. I think even the gasoline situation that we've been hearing about is not overall enough to disrupt the sense of the country being in a sense of normalcy. People are fairly accustomed in Russia, unfortunately. They are accustomed to the fact that there are gasoline shortages in the summer.
It is affecting, the gasoline shortages is affecting certain regions and certain parts of the Russian population to a great deal. And I mean, I don't think you can hide it anymore. If you're the Kremlin, the videos are out there and the news is out there of certain parts and certain regions where there are queues. There are problems. People are fighting. People are upset about the situation. Yeah. I mean, it's out there. Yes. It's out there. And that's something that I haven't seen in previous summers.
I have.
To the extent that we're seeing it now.
I remember 2011 was pretty awful, as I remember. Well, so, I mean, this isn't so...
Last year, I don't remember.
So this isn't so unusual. Yeah. What I would say is it's not going to make people very pleased with a government that doesn't seem to be able to sort this problem out. Whether it's worse this year than, you know, it normally is, I suspect it probably is. But I don't think it is so bad that it is going to shake, as I said, the overall set, especially since usually these situations, by mid-August, they resolve themselves. In fact, they will probably resolve themselves more quickly. By late July, middle July, it won't be such a problem anymore. By the time the elections come up in the autumn, they will be in the past.
I think your comment about the mobilization is correct, but I don't think anyone is talking about mobilization. I mean, you hear Zelensky and some other analysts, fringe analysts, pro-Ukraine, talk about mobilization in September. So, okay, fine. But I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is that there's two wars that are unfolding. The one war in Ukraine on the front lines, Russia's winning. They're obviously winning. They're taking region after region. They've just captured Konstantinovka in a couple of days or a couple of weeks. We're going to hear about Lyman as well. And then you have two more cities left, and that's the defensive belt of Donbass. And then who knows where Russia goes after that. So the war in Ukraine, they're winning. It's the other war that has everyone scratching their heads, saying, what is Putin doing? The Baltic states are picking on Russia. The Europeans are picking on Russia. The NATO's picking on Russia. Trump is mocking Russia. Long-range strikes into Russia, yes. Starlink, yes. Drones, yes. Yeah. And everyone sees a Putin that just is just saying, no problem. At least when it comes to Trump. When it comes to Trump, don't touch him. Don't say a bad thing. Don't criticize. Do not say anything about the United States. They are our partner. They are our friends. They're the ones that understand us. Peskov said we can talk to them. And then that's good. Yeah, we can talk to them. But you can't have Trump showing up in NATO with Rubio saying, we're going to help Ukraine smash Russia. I mean, it looks weird. Peskov gave me an interview to the Swiss media saying, we can call them and we understand as superpowers, as great powers, that we need to work together and we need to prevent a nuclear war. And we have this open dialogue and this open communication. And then a couple of hours later, you have Rubio and Trump saying, we're going to help Ukraine smash Russia. It's weird. And then this, just to wrap up, and you can wrap up the video there, just my thoughts. And we've said this many times. And then you have this, I think they've done it, they've overdone it, this divide Europe from the United States. And let's throw all of the blame on Europe. All the blame goes on Europe for this conflict, all of it. I think people are seeing through that now. I mean, all the blame on Europe, a lot of blame on Europe. But we know who the vassal is, and we know who the master is.
Yeah, I think that what you have said just now actually puts the finger on the fundamental issue, which is I think that this refusal to criticize Trump and to criticize the Americans is immensely exasperating. It exasperates many people in Russia. It exasperates many people in the political system. It exasperates significant sections of the Russian population. And it infuriates people in the military as well, in the sense that the military is fighting, and they know exactly who they're fighting. I mean, they know that they're fighting the Ukrainians on the front lines, but they know whose weapons, who's providing the other side with the weapons, which are being used to fight them. I mean, we no longer, by the way, I think this is a thing to say, we no longer really see European weapon systems in Ukraine, contrary to what many people say. What we're seeing, the drones, both the FPV drones and the drones that are being launched deep inside Russia, are an American technology.
Like the Hornets.
The
Hornets.
Right, okay. Well, but first of all, I mean, the drone that conducts strikes all the way deep inside Russia, in Omsk, wherever, Moscow, they are guided to their targets using Starlink. And that is an American operation, entirely an American operation, authorized by Trump back in the early summer of last year. He did so after a telephone conversation with Zelensky. He said to Zelensky, you know, the Russians are hitting Kiev. Why don't you strike Moscow? And after that, he had a conversation with Radcliffe. We've had the whole story in the New York Times. And the Americans went full in on all of that. And I mean, this drone offensive inside Russia is an American operation, first and foremost. And I'm going to say the same is true, ultimately, of the first-person view drones and the drones, the medium-range drones that have been used to attack tankers in the Sea of Azov, and that have been used to attack Russian positions in Crimea. And when I say Russian positions, I mean bridges, roads, all of those sort of things. These operate with American technologies. The Europeans are not ultimately the people behind this. So the military knows all of this. And the military, the civilian leadership, they are aware who is enabling Ukraine to continue the war. And at the same time, they're being told, we must not criticize Trump. We must not criticize the United States. And this undoubtedly is a cause of enormous frustration. Now, there is a rationale for it, and actually it was provided by Peskov, first in the interview that he gave to Zarubin, and even more in the interview that he gave to the Swiss media. Now, Peskov said some very interesting things. He said, first of all, that the special military operation, the SMO, is essentially a dead letter, is finished. This is a war that is now, it's an actual war that's being fought. The strikes are taking place deep inside our country. They use satellites. Again, he didn't quite make clear whose satellites, but we all know that he's talking about Starlink, that it's the Americans. And reading what Peskov said in these two interviews, it's clear to me, by the way, that we are indeed going to see eventually an upgrade of the SMO. And I said that it might be upgraded to an anti-terrorism operation. A couple of people from Russia contacted me and said, please don't use those words, a counter-terrorism operation will almost certainly be the correct formula, the correct designation. An anti-terrorist operation is what Ukraine carried out in 2014, and it is an unacceptable use of language in Russia. But I think it will be upgraded. But then Peskov said something else, and it was the single most important thing. And by the way, I think this is delusional, but this is what he said. He said that in order to finally secure a peace agreement which settles once and for all the situation in Ukraine and on Russia's western border, we need a renegotiation of the security architecture in Europe. And I think this is the clue that explains Putin's thinking, and not just Putin's, by the way, but others. He still thinks that, you know, eventually, once the war is won, I don't think any longer Putin or anyone else in the Kremlin thinks that there's going to be a negotiated settlement of the conflict itself. Once the war is won, they still believe that they'll be able to move forward at some point, at some stage, with the Americans and come to a deal about the situation in Europe, the new security architecture in Europe. Well, you're shaking your head. I agree.
Never going
to
happen.
I don't think it's ever going to happen. I think this, I know where this would like it to happen. Well, I would love it to happen. But I mean, this takes us back. You see, this takes us back to the era of detente, to Johnson and Kosygin, Nixon and Brezhnev, Gromyko and Kissinger, to the time of the great arms limitation treaties and the Helsinki Treaty and all of those things. And I think Putin and people around him, the team around him, still hope and dream that that may one day happen. It won't happen. I mean, they're talking, they're imagining a United States that does not exist today.
Doesn't exist anymore. I was going to say the same thing. Just to wrap up the video, I bet you, I'll put money on it, I bet you that somewhere in the conversations between Putin and Trump or Russia and the United States, they probably pitched this to Trump. And I imagine that Trump's thought, that's a great idea. He probably even said something, oh yeah, a new security architecture in Europe, that would be great. Yeah. Let's do it. But, you know, Trump says stuff like that, yes, right? And I bet you they latched onto it. And then you know, Trump's team and everyone said, you know, Mr. President, obviously we can't go ahead with this. And Trump was like, okay, whatever. You know, he says this stuff all the time, but I bet you the Russians latched onto it and Putin's team latched onto it. And they now believe that this is possible with a Trump administration. It's never going to happen. I mean, even if Trump genuinely wants it, they're never going to let him do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can I just say, I happen to know for a fact that that did happen because it was discussed in Anchorage. Putin apparently brought, in fact, no, there's no apparent about it. I mean, the Russians themselves have said that Putin brought up the idea of a new security architecture in Europe with the Americans in Anchorage. And Trump said yes. And it was one of the things that made Putin very happy when he came out of the Anchorage meeting. It is never, ever going to happen. Many Americans will agree. You know, get Rubio in front of you, talk to him about a security architecture, a new security architecture in Europe, you'll say, yes, great. It's not going to happen. I mean, we are not talking about the US, the United States of the late 60s and early 70s. Back in December 2021, before the special military operation began, Putin gave a speech to the collegium of the Russian foreign ministry. And he talked all about this. He said, you know, we need to come to some kind of long-term understanding with the Americans in order to secure our Western borders, because that's necessary so that Russia can develop peacefully and successfully economically. We can't be constantly looking over our Western borders, worrying about what's going to happen there. And he said all of that. And he said, you know, I could see that people in the hall, you go to the transcript, you can see, yeah, I could see that all people in the hall, this is the foreign ministry people, are looking, you know, bemused. And I know that, you know, you're all tough, professional people, and you're right to be skeptical, but it's nonetheless what's in our interest and what we should work to try to do. So even before the start of the special military operation, there were doubters, and they were making their doubts to Putin very clear. And they were telling him, this isn't going to happen. It's never going to happen. But Putin himself remains obviously committed to this. And I think the reason he remains committed to it is, again, what he said in that speech. He says that without secure Western borders, we are going to be inhibited in the way in which we develop our economy and the progress that our economy and our society makes, because we are always going to have to be on our guard, and that it takes away attention and energy from pressing domestic things. I have to say that I always used to think that was a very strong argument until my recent trip to Russia, when I said that despite all of the things that have happened over the last few years, that Nantes has nonetheless been considerable economic progress in Russia. I don't think tension in the West is quite as much of a problem for Russian development as Putin himself thinks.
Well, anyway, he's right. Just a final thought. He's right about that.
Yeah.
If he doesn't sort things out with the United States, then there's always going to be this pressure on the Western border. But an argument to Putin would be, you know what? The trying to appease Trump and allowing these strikes to happen, to go through and not taking any measures is encouraging them in that they believe that you have a weak Western border. So it actually encourages them now, even though you're holding out for this new security architecture and you're hoping you get this new security architecture. But on your Western border at the moment, you know, they're looking at it as this is an open border for us.
Yes, I know. I mean,
we can strike as we want, when we want, when we wish.
Yes, I know.
And I think this is what Putin fails to grasp. Maybe he's not grasping. I have a sense that Lavrov understands that a new security architecture is a no-go.
Absolutely.
But I also get the sense that over the last year, this is just a guess, Lavrov and the foreign ministry has kind of been sidelined a bit. That's a guess. It seems like Lavrov was much more active during the Biden years than he was with the Trump presidency.
Yes.
He was given more weight during the Biden years with Blinken and all of that than with the Trump presidency.
I think Lavrov is furious about the fact that interactions with Trump and with the Trump White House are not taking place through the foreign ministry and have been conducted through these irregular channels using people like Dmitriev. I mean, that we've discussed before. And I think Lavrov doesn't like that, and neither does the staff of the foreign ministry. If you listen to what people like Ryabkov and Miroshnik, another Galuzin, another top Russian foreign ministry officials are saying, I mean, it's absolutely clear that they don't think that this is a proper or correct thing at all. And they do not want Witkoff and Kushner in Moscow. And they do not want Witkoff made ambassador to Russia either, which apparently has been floated, an extraordinary idea that has been floated. Yes. So I think that to some extent on this issue, Lavrov is working to rule, actually. I don't think it's just that he's been sidelined exactly. It's that he just doesn't really want to be involved with something that I think he thinks shouldn't be conducted in this way. I think that putting aside the question of appeasement, and I think that there is something in what you say, I mean, a lot in what you say, I think the fundamental problem with this whole idea of a new security architecture in Europe is that it is totally unrealistic. I mean, yes, it would be a good thing to have, obviously. Yes, having to worry about your Western borders is a distraction of attention and energy.
It's a problem. Yeah.
But you know, that is the reality that you're going to have to face, and which you must work with. I mean, you should not say to yourself, if we have to keep on our guard on our Western borders, that's going to inhibit our economic development. What you should be saying is, on the contrary, yes, we have to keep on our guard on our Western borders, but that should spur our economic development. We need to work harder and better because we need to protect ourselves. And that means we need to do things that we have not done in the past, like develop our aerospace industry and upgrade our microeconomics industries, which we are now doing because we must. So, you know, this is getting everything the wrong way around. It's staking too much in something that's never going to happen at the cost of not earlier seizing opportunities which were there. Russia is actually been quite successful in upgrading its aerospace industries. It's developing new engines for aircraft, a very difficult technology, by the way. It's making significant progress in building its own microchip industry, more than people understand. And this is a topic which we might want to discuss in another program because it's a complex one. Machine building is booming. In a period when, thanks to the central bank, economic growth has slowed significantly in Russia, machine building grew by 8% this year, in the first 6 months of this year. So, you know, conflict with the West need not be the drain on Russian resources that Putin believes it to be. Again, I suspect that here he has been listening to the wrong people, and perhaps he's over-influenced by the Soviet experience, when the Soviet Union's commitment to the arms race, its attempt to maintain strategic parity with the United States, whilst also maintaining enormous conventional forces and military forces against China, did sap its economic energies. I think that we are in a completely different economic space. And anyway, besides, I mean, it's pointless giving up time and energy pursuing something, a new security architecture in Europe, which the Americans will never agree to.
You know what it is, a final point? No speaking with the United States for 4 years under Biden, and then they get Trump, who does speak with Russia. And the Kremlin has this belief that this is our final chance to actually work something out with the United States.
No doubt.
And they believe that Trump is their final opportunity,
no doubt,
to discuss a new security architecture, a new way of doing things.
No doubt.
And so they're investing everything in this one man, in this presidency, because they believe, and maybe yes, rightly so, that this is their one and only shot. Because
yes,
4 years, no speaking with Biden, no speaking with Obama, pretty much. I mean, pretty Obama was also terrible. Yeah. And so they're saying this is it. This is our only chance. But
Trump is worse. Because actually is the person who's sending missiles into your and drones into your country. So, but I fundamentally know. I agree with you, and I think that is an important point. And I think you're making a very important point. And there is undoubtedly this psychological thing. But the fact that Trump is talking to you is very good and very nice. And I, by the way, I should say that I absolutely do support contacts between the Americans and the Russians. I think we'd be unbelievably dangerous if we didn't have them. But expecting that at some point over the next few years, something is going to happen which will give you this great new security architecture in Europe, I think that is changing. That is chasing a mirage. I mean, it is not going to happen. And I think that it's nice to talk, but one has to be realistic and accept the fundamental truth. It's just never going to happen. And you shouldn't invest too much time and energy pursuing an objective that cannot be achieved.
Yeah. All right. We will end the video there. TheDurant.locals.com. We are on X, we're on Rumble, we're on Telegram. Go to Durant Shop, pick up some merch. We are also on Substack. All those links in the description box down below. Take care.